The first one will be Chara Idaman. He's a PhD student at University of Binghamton and in sociology. Then we'll have George Souvlis, who's a PhD student at European University Institute in Florence. And then finally, we'll end with David Broder, who is the Europe editor at Jacobin. So we'll do the three, and then we'll open up for questions and answers at the end. Okay, thanks.
Good afternoon. A.J. Oxbaum, along with other British Marxist historians, was deeply influenced by the French Annales school. However, they aimed to develop a specifically Marxist interpretation of capitalist history that distinguished them from the latter. Their focus was hence neither specially on the Mediterranean and the Atlantic, nor historically on the long 16th century. They rather intended to comprehend what set England apart from or apart on a divergent trajectory from the medieval times onwards. Their underlying theoretical argument was that capitalism is not simply a commercial economy, but rather a mode of production based on capital and wage-labor relationship. Hobsbawm methodologically employed Braudel's conception of a long century, not only in its seminal three volumes, which examined the long 19th century, but also in order to distinguish between different stages of European pre-capitalism. However, he maintained that until the crisis of the 17th century, the conditions for capitalism had not yet been established to unleash the dual revolutions. In this presentation, I will question Hobsbawm's historical theorization. I will argue that Hobsbawm's theory is not a theory of transition to capitalism, but rather a theory of development of world hegemony in general and of British hegemony in particular. According to Hobsbawm, the development of capitalism from the year 1000 to 1800 was characterized by two important interruptions, the crises of 14th and 17th centuries. In his words, it included a number of demonstrably false starts. The period between 1000 and the early 14th century witnessed widespread rapid economic development marking the peak of feudalism. Population grew, agricultural and manufactural production increased, trade expanded, and cities and urban culture revived. There was striking economic expansion of Western feudalism against the Islamic East, migration, colonization, and establishment of trade posts. However, this expansion came to an end in the crisis of 14th and 15th centuries, which resulted in the reversal of previous trends, collapse of large-scale feudal agriculture, manufacturers, international trade, and population. There was widespread social revolution and ideological crisis. From the mid-15th century to the mid-17th century, economic expansion was renewed. The basis and superstructure of feudal society demonstrated first signs of breakdown in the forms of reformation and bourgeois revolution in the Netherlands, and the European traders and conquerors made their first breakout in the Americas and the Indian Ocean. Hobsbawm recognized that Marx regarded this period as the beginning of the capitalist era. Nevertheless, this second phase of expansion too was followed by a major period of crisis, adjustment, and setback, i.e. the crisis of the 17th century. This crisis also coincided with the first clear breakthrough of bourgeois society, the English Revolution. After this final crisis, this renewed and general expansion culminated in the definitive triumph of the capitalist society in the simultaneous two revolutions, the British Industrial Revolution and the French Revolution, both occurring in the last quarter of the 18th century. Hobsbawm maintained that the development of capitalism between 1000 and 1800 progressed neither in the same direction nor at the same rate across Europe. However, he underlined that there was a general consensus, and I quote, "Nobody has seriously maintained that capitalism prevailed before the 16th or that feudalism prevailed after the 18th century." In other words, it was crucial for his analysis to demonstrate that capitalism had not emerged in the 16th century and the 17th century crisis was the turning point for capitalist development. Hobsbawm acknowledged that the 16th century came closer to the creation of conditions of capitalist mode of production than any previous age. However, the social organization of production, dominated by landlords in the countryside and guilds in towns, inhibited the development of capitalism. Firstly, there was little technical innovation, which gradually resulted in diminishing returns, food shortages, famines, and epidemics. Secondly, the rural population, under triple pressure from landlords, townsmen, and states, were less capable to protect themselves against famines and war. The agricultural prices rose more rapidly than the industrial prices, and the profit margins of the manufacturers were squeezed. This was further exacerbated by rising labor costs. In short, the economic expansion was still taking place within a pre-capitalist framework. According to Hobsbawm, the 17th century crisis had three peculiar results. Firstly, it tended to weaken feudal enterprises more than the progressive ones. Secondly, it turned European economies and their colonies into a single economic entity. And thirdly, it resulted in bourgeois revolutions. The 17th century crisis, in contrast to the 14th century crisis, resulted in the concentration of economic power both in the countryside and cities. The vast agricultural food, raw material, and labor surplus necessary for industrialization could only be achieved by technical revolution, that is, raising productivity and expanding cultivated area through capitalist farming. From the middle of the 17th century onwards, Low Countries and England showed the signs of agricultural revolution. In industry, the 17th century crisis resulted in the elimination of crop production of the towns and its replacement of large-scale concentration of putting out system in the countryside. Although this new system initially created islands of self-sufficiency and was dependent of commercial capital and financial capital, it helped dissolve the agrarian structures and provided means of rapid industrialization before the advent of factory system. One key area that set Britain apart from both Netherlands and France was the dominance of manufacturing policy over trade and finance. This could not have happened without a bourgeois revolution, however enlightened the ancien regime or market-oriented the republic were. Hence, bourgeois revolutions were a necessary condition for the development of capitalism. Once these conditions were set, all that was necessary was a forced drought. And how was this forced drought to be generated? Firstly, all the trade of the countries that had to be directly or indirectly concentrated at the hand of the most industrialized countries, especially England. And secondly, these industrialized countries, yet again England, had to generate a large and expanded home market, markets for mass production and consumption. Thirdly, a new colonial system had to be established, that is, slave plantations producing cotton for the English textile industry. Consequently, England was ready for takeoff and the entire world was set on a course of sustained economic growth. In contrast to Hobsbawm, I would argue that the decisive break in the history of capitalism was the 14th century crisis. Following this crisis, the southern and northern feudal world economies collapsed. The capitalist world economy blew into existence out of this collapse. In the face of peasant resistance and rebellion, the feudal landlords could neither usurp their peasants, except for east of Elbe, nor resist capitalist attempts to take control of production. What distinguished capitalist world economy from all previous socio-ecological formations was hence the infiltration of capital into the sphere of production. Only when productive capital infiltrated the sphere of production could the continuous production of surplus value, endless appropriation of nature, and ceaseless accumulation of capital could be guaranteed. Transition was therefore nothing other than the emergence of socio-ecological conditions for productive capital to reorganize the mode of appropriation of nature in various rural and urban activities. All these socio-ecological and political transformations, however, did not occur at the same time and at the same rate across the historical geography of the capitalist world economy. The conditions and outcomes of these processes were conditioned by the unintended consequences of balance of class forces and courses of class struggles. Countries where the balance of class forces favored the capitalists became the organizing centers of capitalist production, i.e. the core countries, while the countries where the balance of class forces favored the landlords became the peripheral peripheral countries. In other words, the axial division of labor formed by the various forms of commodity production exhibited patterns of uneven and combined development, uneven economic, military, political, and cultural balance of power between the core and peripheral regions. Moreover, the differences between countries were not limited to core and periphery differences. There were also differences among the core and periphery, between periphery and semi-periphery, and between hegemon and other core countries. Among the core states, there emerged one leading state which would economically, politically, culturally, and militarily dominate all others and orchestrate the world economy under imperatives of capital accumulation. Each hegemonic cycle was premised upon an extractive industrial regime of capital accumulation, which created its new sets of opportunities and constraints. The accumulation strategies that offered productive superiority progressively exhausted the supply of cheap labor and commodity inputs. At some point, this exhaustion manifested itself in faltering productivity, falling profitability, and rising commodity prices. Finally, at the point of exhaustion, each hegemonic cycle was replaced by a new and yet more expensive cycle. Historically, emergence of hegemonies was necessary but not sufficient condition for transition to capitalist world economy. In the aftermath of Black Death and socio-ecological collapse of European feudalism, Venice, the first world hegemon, emerged as the organizing center of the capitalist world economy in the first long 16th century. Circa 1450-1550. Furthermore, it also militarily stabilized the world economy by successfully resisting the world imperial projects of the Habsburgs under Charles V from within and the Ottomans from without. Moreover, the Iberian and Dutch hegemonic competition to replace the Venetian hegemony in the second long 16th century, circa 1550-1650, further expanded and intensified the speed, scale, and scope of capitalist activities. In doing so, they conclusively consolidated the capitalist world economy. Venice was an exceptional city, both socio-ecologically and politically. Its unique constitution in the lagoon environment, the lack of a parasitic landlord class, availability of capital, existence of a colonial empire, and the constant flow of raw materials, food, energy, silver, and laborers from the East, colonies, and the rest of Europe set the conditions of the industrialization of Venice starting in the 15th century. The Venetian territory was composed of three zones, the Dogado, the capital city and its immediate surroundings, the towns and districts of Terraferma, and Stato da Mar, the colonies. Stato da Mar constituted a scattered empire reminiscent of the Spanish, Portuguese, and Dutch empires in the following century. In addition to state monopoly in salt, the Venetian economy supplied its cheap labor force for the navy and industries, and cheap raw materials for construction and comestibles for daily consumption from the Stato da Mar. In return, colonies were markets for Venetian manufacturers. The earliest and most significant of productive colonial enterprises were sugar plantations utilizing machinery and employing slave labor established by Federico Corner in Episcopi Cyprus. Terraferma was a center of both extractive and manufacturing industries. The Venetian patricians improved agricultural production by investing in new technologies and championed land reclamation and clearing of forests in Terraferma. Furthermore, Terraferma was also a major mining area. There were 15 iron melting ovens in Brescia's territory, which represented the absolute majority of such ovens in the Italian peninsula. The products of these forges were used in either agriculture, that is, development of the Venetian home market a la Lenin, or in arms industry. Finally, Terraferma was also a major industrial center on its own, producing knitwear, printing, leatherworks, paper, glass, sunlight trade, and most importantly, woolen and silk textiles. Multiple forms of commodity production characterized wool and silk production, putting out system, domestic industry, and large-scale capitalist enterprises. However, unlike the city, export-oriented Veneto industry relied on local wool and silk resources. Availability of local energy resources, water and timber, and obtainability of mid and high quality wool fueled the woolen textiles, whereas the spread of silk production was conditioned by cultivation of mulberries and raising of silkworms, especially around Vicenza and Verona during the 15th century. Based on the provision of cheap labor, raw materials, energy, and food, Renaissance spirits developed a variety of industries: wool and textiles, glassworks, construction, leather products, gold and silversmithing, printing, and shipbuilding, and became one of the greatest industrial centers of Europe. Different forms of commodity-producing labor, especially petty commodities-producing artisans and wage laborers, executed different stages of production. In 1586, according to Rapp's calculations, the total workforce was around 34,000 in a population of 150,000. Two-thirds of the labor force was skilled laborers, whereas one-third was unskilled laborers. The provision of food, raw materials, and laborers relied on local and international supply chains. The productive accumulation strategy allowed Venetian capitalists and state to dominate the nascent capitalist world economy in the first 16th century. By the beginning of the second 16th century, however, Venice had begun to lag behind emergent centers of capital accumulation. Towards the end of the 16th century and in the 17th century, Venice, along with the other Italian states, would experience a relative productive decline despite continuing to expand in absolute terms. It could no longer control and organize nature and labor on a scale and scope as imperatives of capital accumulation demanded. Consequently, two hegemonic challengers emerged: Iberia and United Provinces. Both were able to do what Venetians failed to do: organize nature, labor, and capital on a greater scale, speed, and scope. Consequently, the Iberians and the Dutch fought an 80-year-long between themselves and led a 30-year-long European war. The Dutch emerged as the new hegemon. The so-called 17th century crisis hence represented a transition not from pre-capitalism to capitalism, but rather from Venetian to Dutch hegemony. When Spain and its colonies were experiencing agroecological, industrial, and demographic contraction, the United Provinces were ready to take off. One of the distinguishing features of Northern Netherlands was the weakness of seigneurial relations. Colonization of these inhospitable lands allowed the peasants to establish themselves as pre-settlers. The scarcity of land for both agricultural and animal husbandry demanded the increase of productivity. These set the conditions for development of capitalist social property relations in northern maritime Netherlands in the 16th and 17th centuries. Furthermore, those Dutch farmers who continued with agriculture moved away from grain production and instead produced cash crops for Dutch industry. Aside from grains imported from east of Elbe and local dairy production, the most important source of food was fish. In contrast to agriculture, where petty commodity production prevailed, The fish industry was dominated by capitalist relations of production. The Baltic's relation to Amsterdam was similar to the Stato de Mars to Venice. It supplied the Dutch economy with cheap labor, raw materials, and food supplies, and in return, Baltic provided markets for Dutch manufacturers. Starting with the 1500s, Netherlands began to experience long-sustained demographic growth until the last quarter of the 17th century. The population of Netherlands was approximately 1 million in 1500, and it was around 2 million in 1650. Already by the beginning of the 16th century, Netherlands was characterized by high urbanization rate and population density. Different types of industries were established in the United Provinces: textiles, ceramic industries, food processing, paper making and printing, food processing, beverage production, construction, woodworking, sawmilling, and shipbuilding. Saardam housed the biggest shipyard in the world. Shipbuilding involved Fordist and Taylor's methods of production, just like Venetian arsenale. Mechanical saws and hoists were used, and production was based on interchangeable parts. However, despite these initial productive priorities, the United States provinces too began to lag behind emergent centers of capital accumulation from 1730s onwards. This would result in new hegemonic competition between France and Britain, in which the latter would prove to be victorious. In conclusion, my intention is not to dismiss or to discard Hobsbawm, at least altogether. I rather argue that hegemony is a systemic cumulative, expansive, and novel regimes of extractive industrial capital accumulation were intrinsically related to transition to capitalism, and Hobsbawm's theory offers valuable insights in this regard. Furthermore, although I have not been able to discuss the subject in this presentation, his periodization of British hegemony in his three volumes too provides valuable insights not only for previous Venetian and Dutch hegemonies, but also for the subsequent American hegemony. However, this would give us a picture completely different from the one he gives us in the short 20th century. Thank you.
Okay. Erich Hobsbawm is possibly the only historian who has been both so praised for his work and so criticized for the politics he endorsed throughout his life. Even today, most accounts of his work display a polemic zeal against his political stance that even ardent Cold Warriors would have been hesitant about using in the public debates of their time. This paper attempts to offer a temperate though critical understanding of the relationship between Hobsbawm politics and his work as a historian. I argue that if we are to grasp this complicated relationship effectively, we need to distinguish between the Marxist methodology that he used as his main, not though exclusively analytical framework, and his popular frontist understanding of politics, as well as his support for the Soviet Union in the post-war era. The former was not reducible to the latter, or vice versa. The Marxist analytical tools that he used in his studies were chosen according to the demands of the research that he was undertaking. Hobsbawm politics was an outcome of his politicization during the 20s and 30s in the ranks of the Communist International. It is true the two were in some sense inextricably linked, but they were also characterized by relative autonomy. Hobsbawm's work can be divided in four analytical distinct historical phases, which I present in this paper. The first part covers the years of Hobsbawm formation, the interwar period and World War II. The following section examines his intellectual production during the 1960s, a decade in which a British historian wrote some of his most influential studies, building on the interests of the British Marxist tradition that has been named History from Below. The third one reconstructs his tetralogy in the formation of the modern world. And finally, I present the political debates in which he was involved from the 1980s onwards, a period which Erich Hobsbawm acquired the status of a public intellectual. It is a paper that I have been sent long ago, and so it is a concentrated version of it. So yeah, I will be brief in this. So Hobsbawm's formative years. Erich Hobsbawm was born in Alexandria on 19th June 1917, a few months before the October Revolution and one and a half years before the conclusion of World War I, which signaled the end of the empires and the formation of a modern nation state. His parents, the Austrian mother and the British father, were Jewish. The first 20 years of Hobsbawm's life can be described as the outcome of these two wider historical processes. He became a communist as he grew up in Europe polarized between communism and the far right. In the mid-1931, a few months before official unemployment figures in Germany reached the historical peak of 6 million, the orphaned Eric and his sister moved to Berlin in order to live with their aunt and uncle. In autumn 1932, he joined the communist secondary school student organizations, the Socialist Schülerbund. This political engagement in the communist cause would last until the end of his life, even if in changing forms. In 1993, Erich and his sister moved to London, and after finishing school, he started his undergraduate degree at King's College, Cambridge, where he studied history. Here, he was encountered with a Marxist historical analysis and joined the student branch of the Communist Party of Great Britain. The most crucial political experience for Hobsbawm and many of his peers was between 1934 and 1939, in the years of the Popular Front, where the Communists sought to build an anti-fascist alliance with the Social Democratic and Liberal bourgeois parties. As he acknowledged in his autobiography, This had a lasting influence on him throughout his life. Quotes, popular front, politics continues to determine my strategic thinking in politics to this day. End of quotes. However, the popular front did not influence only the way in which he perceived politics, but also to a certain degree the type of historiography which he practiced. The Comintern's ideological policy was based on an analysis that linked the conjectural political assessments of that time with the struggles and figures from the past. The echoes of this approach were illustrated by the efforts of the Communist Party Historians Group, of which Hobsbawm was a prominent member. The group sought to unearth the past traditions, experiences and struggles of the British people in order to create a political lineage that informed the politics of its own time. So the second part, I speak about his writing during the 1960s, writing people's history. The first monograph that Eric Hobsbawm wrote was Primitive Rebels, studies in a hard forms of social movements in the 19th and 20th century. This groundbreaking study focuses on explaining the different ways in which traditional societies and more precisely specific groups of people with know-how in weaponry react to the market integration. The time period that the study covers is the last 30 years of the long 19th century. During these decades, the logic of the market was economically abandoned throughout the world via imperialist forms of domination. Politically, a series of nation-states began to emerge in Europe, a process that was completed with the end of the World War I and the two revolutions of 1917. These processes were not, however, abandoned without the resistance from below. From people that experienced the dissolution of their societies as markets were entrenched. The traditional form of resistance and rebellion corresponded to the historical context from which they emerged. Thus, in this study, Hobsbawm examines the precedents of the modern revolutionaries. The main concept on which the study builds is the social bandit, referring to those vote peasant outlaws whom the Lord and the state regards as criminals but who remain peasant society and are considered by their people as heroes, as champions, avengers, fighters for just, perhaps even leaders of liberation, and in any case meant to be admired, helped and supported. End of quotes. Why then social? Because there were explicit class connotations in the way Hobsbawm built his argumentations. This type of bandits are structural bound to the peasantry, they are its defenders, to the extent that the rule of law has not yet been universalized and several social layers were left unprotected by the antinomies that emerged in the transitory phases of the building. The political outlook of the bandits was a primitive one, corresponding to the class they represented. The repertoire of action, informed by traditional values, attempted to bring back the previous order of things and not to build a new one. These features makes them different from the modern labor movement, which is organized the class itself, with a specific ideology, socialism, and with the aim of transforming the existing offer or things into a new one that will qualitatively differ from its predecessor. Published a decade later, Bandits built upon the themes and the issues that were raised in Primitive Rebels. The topic of social protection is also central to Captain Swing, co-written with George Root, which reconstructs, as the title indicates, the history of the English agriculture wage laborers uprising of the 1930s. The laborers, like the social bandits, did not aim at the revolution, but at the restoration of the previous order of things. This, among other factors, led to the defeat of the movement, though the struggle did not go waste. Hobsbawm's next book, Labor Men, was a collection of essays focused on collective action, but this time of a modern type. Three main themes are examined in this study: the transformation of traditional political action into modern forms of organization, the role of the religion in 19th century British society, more precisely among the working classes, and the impact, or more accurately, the non-impact of Marx theories on the making of the Labour Party. Hobsbawm's most significant contribution in this volume is his refinement of the concept of the labour aristocracy. This refers to an upper and privileged stratum of the manual working class, which for many Marx scholars is also a basis for explaining working class activity in the Victorian and Edwardian Britain and beyond. According to Hobsbawm, the labor aristocracy as a historical phenomenon emerges, votes when the economic circumstances of capitalism make it possible to grant significant concessions to its proletariat, within which certain strata of workers manage by means of their special scarcity skill, strategic position, organizational strength to establish notably better conditions for themselves than the rest. End of quotes. Between 1840 and 1890 in Britain, a new layer of skilled workers emerged in a new industries such as cotton textiles and metalworking, quotes, where machinery was imperfect and depended on some significant manual skill. End of quotes. It was these workers who were best able to establish exclusivist craft unions that used apprenticeship votes to make their labor artificially scarce by restricting entry to their profession. Hobsbawm, a later collection of works of labor, develops similar themes and topics of labor men through by then a labor aristocracy, has become established as the skilled field of research. Thus, it builds upon the issues and problems that have been raised by the series of studies on labor history. However, Hobsbawm's studies on labor history were not informed by the normative deal of value-free research that had long reigned among historians and that dominated the field of social science in the post-war era, but by an explicit political commitment. Researching and writing for the labor movement, for Hobsbawm should rather be combined with a sound scholarship. The task of academic historians should be, quote, to consolidate the new territories won by the committed, end of quote. Now I pass to the tetralogy of the modern world. While Hobsbawm's studies on Butterby and the British labor movement established him as an authoritative historian within the Marxist circles and the academic world, his tetralogy on the making of the modern world, especially in the last volume, Age of Extremes, was responsible for his work generally from the college of the university to the public sphere. This made him one of the most noted and widely read historians of the last three decades all around the world. It was written over a time span of more than 30 years. The first book published in 1962 and the last one 32 years later in 1994. This time distance between the writing of the four volumes had an impact on the narration, the epistemology and the politics and underpinned the project. The first and the second volumes are each organized with two major sections on development and results. There's implicit materialist, if not Marxist, message in the architecture of this volume. The developments are economic, then political and military, while the results are expressed in social structures, then political ideology, and finally in the cultural level, science, religion, and arts. The first volume of the trilogy focuses on the dual revolution that largely shaped the modern world as we know it today, the industrial and French revolution. The former was responsible for the establishment of economic liberalism, the latter for its political form, the modern institution through which the popular will was expressed, with parliament being the most prominent. In Hobsbawm, long 19th century, the bourgeois was the class that best expressed these values and realities. It was the central political actor that consciously asserted its domination throughout the century by establishing an efficient legal political system of property relations, as it slowly but steadily sidelined the ancient regime. The second volume, The Age of Capital, focuses, as the title indicates, on the ascendancy of global capital between 1848 and 1875. In this period, the European bourgeoisie lost its progressive political role as it compromised with the conservative aristocratic status quo that was threatened by the working classes. Indeed, in the meantime, this later has organized more effectively than at the beginning of the century when the Industrial Revolution had not yet spread throughout the continent. According to Hobsbawm's description of this shift, the British Industrial Revolution had swallowed the French Political Revolution, end of quote. This, the political promises of 1879 were foreshadowed, and the aims of the revolution of 1848, far from being fulfilled, remained an open chapter for the next generation of revolutionaries. These defeats explain the capitalist advance that took place in the following decades, the technological innovations that accomplished this new cycle of capitalist accumulation allowed a new expansive phase in a new lands outside the European continent. By the end of this period, the capitalist integration of the globe was almost complete. The age of empire is the last of the three volumes that Hobsbawm wrote on the long 19th century. It shows how the century of the triumph of capitalism ended with the cataclysm of the Great War. The imperial expansion that took place the last quarter of the 19th century was the capitalist solution to the crisis of profitability of 1873 till 1896. It gave shape to a new world governed by combined and uneven development between dominant and dominated states, a geopolitical equilibrium that had changed, that changed substantially only with the liberation movements that emerged during the post-war period. In this period, European governments started one after the other to give up the laissez-faire policies and adopt protectionist tariffs. The culmination of Hobsbawm's synthesis of the making of the modern world is the age of extremes, the short 20th century. In this study, there's an explicit and structural chronological periodization in three dialectical interlinked phases. The first, the age of catastrophe, extends from the First to the Second World War. The second, the Golden Age, covers the first quarter of the post-war period till the oil crash of 1973, the affluent period of the Western capitalist world with the emblematic welfare state, product of Keynesian regulation. The third phase, landslide, is the area of neoliberal order where the global economy became dominated by international banks and multinational corporations outside the control of the national states. Between this phase, two global shifts take place. The first is the paradigm shift from an unorganized to an organized form of capitalism, in other words, the arrival of the neoliberal order, and the second is the collapse of the Soviet Union. The image of the new order that Hobsbawm provided is rather bleak. The economic stability of the previous decades was substituted by recurrent periodic crises that put in doubt all the certainties, employment, social security, pensions of the post-war Western world. The role of the states in this new conjuncture was reduced significantly, with their fate now dictated by international financial capital and its needs. The planned economy of the third world states experienced equal, if not bigger, difficulties. In many cases, these economies could not sustain themselves, so they resorted to IMF financing that adjusted them to the new global order. The collapse of the social status quo, both the Russian and the Yugoslav versions, can also be explained with a reference to this shift. Again, though, the sea change of the 1970s, but that swept across the world, is not interpreted with tools deriving from Marxist economic analysis. Absent, then, are both in the types of explanation that are common in Marxist economics, the horizontal structure of antagonism between capital and the vertical conflict between labor and capital. So now it's the last phase, from just a Marxist to a public intellectual. The fourth phase of Hobsbawm's career encompasses the period between his retirement from Birkbeck in 1982 and the end of his life. In the context of the Thatcherist attack on the working class in Britain, a shift took place from Hobsbawm's role as intellectual that acted within the circles of the British left to that of a public intellectual on a large stage. Hobsbawm played a key role within the debate on the future of the Labour Party and its strategy in the 1980s. Despite being a member of another party, he was writing systematically for Marxism Today, a theoretical journal. The Communist Party of Great Britain had lost its specific identity and now seemed to function more like a think tank attempting to influence the Labour Party rather a party unto itself. Hobsbawm's lack of belief in class politics and his rise as an intellectual figure enjoying a large audience were significant in this regard. In this view, one of the reasons for Labour's failure was the Labour's left insistent focus on a classical class-based analysis. The appropriate political response in the new conjuncture was rather the formation of an anti-Thatcher front, including the right-wing split from Labour, SDP, and their liberal allies, also conceived as anti-Thatcher forces. The key theoretical influence within the ranks of the Communist Party of Great Britain, of Hobsbawm as well, at that period was Antonio Gramsci. The version of Gramscianism that promoted by parties and organic intellectuals of the Eurocommunist strat, though, was a very specific one, as David Forgas has endorsed. Quotes. This Gramsci is squarely a post-Leninist, a theorist of broader alliances which are negotiated rather than pre-given, popular democratic and not just class alliance. He's the theorist of a war of position rather than frontal assault on the state, the figure who provides the conceptual keys, organic crisis hegemony, national popular, which enable one to unlock the mysteries of the Thatcherist solution to the crisis of British capitalism and simultaneously to expose the weakness of laborism and ultra-leftism in resisting and transcending it. Almost two decades later, Hobsbawm came back rediscussing some of the aspects of his issues he touched upon in the 1980s with his book How to Change the World Without How to Change the World, Tales of Marx and Marx. It was his last book published while he was still alive. In contrast to what the title suggests, this was not a manual for global proletarian revolution, I'm finishing, but a collection of his own texts on the intellectual history of Marx and Marxism. The second part devoted particular attention to Gramsci after Marx, the Marxist figure who was the most influenced British historian. Hobsbawm that Marx's works should be approached both as an engagement with the conjecture and as an attempt to connect theory and praxis in a constructive way. Given the differences between Marx and the present times, for Hobsbawm, the classical writings, strategic instructions have a limited value for current struggles. He considers them dangerous even to use as a set of precedents. What could be learned from Marx was his method of facing the task of analysis and action rather than ready-made lessons to be derived from classic texts. End of quotes. The British historian did not, however, have the same hesitations over Gramsci, who believed could still inform social strategist decisions. The Sardinian communist, in his view, was the quote, most original thinker produced in the West since 1917. End of quotes. Hobsbawm endorsed that he attempted to offer an open-ended take of his work. Quote, he is a Marxist and indeed a Leninist, and I don't propose to waste any time by defining him against the accusations of various sectarians who claim to know exactly what is and what is not Marxist and not have a copyright in their own version of Marxism. End of quote. A careful reading of Hobsbawm's account shows that he was close to the version of Gramscianism that developed within and around the communist part of Great Britain that I described above. Hobsbawm argued in this line that, quote, and naturally the writing of hegemony so far as possible before the transfer of power is particularly important in countries where the core of ruling class power lies in the subalternity of the masses rather than in coercion. This is case in most Western countries, whatever the ultra-left says, and however unquestioned the fact that in the last analysis coercion is there to be used. As we may see, Chile and Uruguay, beyond a certain point, the use of coercion to maintain rule becomes frankly incompatible with the use of apparent or real consent, and the rulers have to choose between the alternatives of hegemony and force, the velvet glove and the iron fist. End of quote. From this quote, it's difficult, if not impossible, to argue that Hobsbawm offers an open-ended reading of Gramsci and Marx. Rather, it seems that he articulates a specific kind of polemic towards an understanding that promotes coercion as equally necessary aspect of the process of transition to socialism. Was Gramsci, however, an advocate of the long march through the institution as the necessary strategy for the transition to a non-capitalist social formation and violence as a means that can be used in this end only in the last instance? Historically, though, it has been proved that in conditions, though, of state of exception, the balance between consensus and force changed in favor of the former. The moment of the crisis, though defined as an outcome of the long process fight through the institutions, is rather a conjectural phenomenon. Gramsci was well aware of this political diagnosis. In this perspective, it should be more proper to argue, following Dylan Riley's reasoning, that Gramsci was also a revolutionary, not a Euro-communist or a theorist of radical democracy. He was a man who deeply understood and appreciated the value of democracy and liberalism, yet he never abandoned his essential Leninist conception of revolutionary transformation. Indeed, for him, a conjectural social revolution with its inevitable transnational dictatorship was the path to the realization of the utopian dream of a regulated society. So,
okay, so I'm going to talk about Eric Hobsbawm's relationship with the Italian Communist Party. There's several aspects of Hobsbawm's work which lend themselves to his depoliticization. Very notable, of course, upon his death, where he was treated as something of a national hero. Simon Sharma, for instance, saying that part of Hobsbawm's success lay in him decoupling the tools of Marxism from communism. And, of course, one can very well draw on tools from Marx and indeed from Gramsci, but without being a historian of communism as such. Of course, Hobsbawm's relationship to the CPGB is not similar to that, for example, of Paolo Spriano, the great historian of the Italian Communist Party, who, as well as being a party member, wrote a sort of semi-official history of the party, albeit a scholarly one. Of course, the work of the British Communist Historians Group was informed by a a popular frontist understanding of the role of the historian to recover a tradition of revolt and of the history of subversion in British history. But Hobsbawm was not as such a historian of communism. It's also to be considered that, for instance, when in his memoir Interesting Times, discussing why he didn't leave the Communist Party in 1956, when other British communist group historians did, Hobsbawm kind of falls back on this kind of claim, which is like, well, having been a Jew in Germany and entered the Comintern in that sort of heroic phase, a sort of loyalty bound him to the party nonetheless, even after 56. Of course, it could also be said that it's not entirely true that all of the British communist historians group split with the party, or indeed for that reason, if one thinks, for example, of George Thompson, the classicist, who was pro-Chinese, if anything. So what I want to do in this paper is really to take seriously Hobsbawm's own political engagement, and in particular his view of the Italian Communist Party as not only a sort of party that was following its own national path or which had succeeded in recuperating a Gramscian tradition, but rather as a party whose discourse and whose direction actually pointed a way forward for all communist parties. Of course, being a member of the CPGB, itself something of a sect, Hobsbawm said he was really a spiritual member of the PCI, the Italian party. But of course, it's also indicative that he didn't choose as an alternative the French Communist Party, with which he had much earlier relations. Hobsbawm had visited France for student congresses in 37 and 39, also had some visits to France and with PCF historians in the immediate post-war period. So in this paper, I'm going to explain why Hobsbawm's engagement with the PCI actually began before 56 and wasn't only a reaction against Hungary. Then I'm going to talk about his discovery of Gramsci, but then I'm going to talk about the historic compromise and the ways in which Hobsbawm's engagement with the PCI wasn't just limited to a positive reception of Gramsci. Okay, so I'm going to start the second section by reading a 2007 quote from Hobsbawm in which he explains the origins of his interest in Italy. He writes, "I believe that we in Britain were among the first internationally to take note of Gramsci, mainly because of the many British soldiers who came home after fighting the war in Italy, where they'd heard of him. I believe it was through some of them that I myself first heard of Gramsci, from men like the poet Hamish Henderson, a brilliant writer and great drinker, a Scot who was among the first to translate the letters from prison, and also from other people who pushed me to look at Gramsci's texts. One of them, and he's referring to Lewis Marx, was first to produce an anthology of Gramsci texts in England in the 50s, The Modern Prince, perhaps the first collection published outside of Italy." Here Hobsbawm was perhaps rather modest. The 1957 collection, The Modern Prince, was published partly upon his own initiative. And indeed, he had a prior engagement with Italy, thanks to his close ties at Cambridge to Maurice Dobb, and through him to Piero Sraffa. Sraffa and Hobsbawm had first met there in 1950 during the unsuccessful campaign to elect Nehru as the Chancellor of Cambridge University to replace the outgoing Chancellor, the colonialist Jan Smuts. Sraffa had, apart from Tatiana Schuchte, Gramsci's sister-in-law, been the key contact between Gramsci in prison and then the essentially exiled leadership of the Communist Party. Although in his early 50s contacts with Hobsbawm, Sraffa was apparently actually rather kept this rather on the down low, we might say, and how extensive his involvement had been. One might also question how realistic was Hobsbawm's account of returning soldiers telling him about Gramsci. In fact, of course, even during the resistance, Gramsci was mainly invoked by the PCI as an anti-fascist martyr rather than venerated for his own particular ideas. While in April 1944, in an article in L'Unità, the Communist Party, it was a daily in Liberatorsly, Toglietti had indicated the existence of the prison notebooks. Of course, the prison notebooks weren't published when they were produced, but only after the war. So the first edition of the letters from prison was in 1947, then from 1948 till 1951, Togliatti's abridged and thematic edition of the prison notebooks was produced. And this operation would have been impossible without Schraffer's own direct intervention. And it was in August 1951 that Hobsbawm made his first ever visit to Italy, where he went to the Gramsci Foundation. In Italy, he was also particularly in touch with a Florentine historian called Delio Cantimori, who was a historian of 18th century heretics. So obviously had a certain overlap with Hobsbawm's own interest in studying sort of pre-labour movement, radical and rebellious traditions. And there, of course, in 51, the very year that the prison notebooks were finished, Hobsbawm was able to discuss with Cantimori, but also with historians like Reggiani, of Gramsci's own particular emphasis on recovering the history of the subaltern and indeed in linking it to national history. In further trips to Italy around the same period, also helped Hobsbawm's own writing of this specific type. If we think, for example, he visited Sicily for the first time in 1953, which had very much had a presence on, sorry, an impact on his 1959 book *Primitive Rebels*. Of course, it is true that Gramsci's British reception was linked to what Hobden called the *Rezeptionsgeschichte*. I can't speak German. History of the reception of Gramsci's work, linked to the events of 1956, so Khrushchev's secret speech, and then the Soviet invasion of Hungary. And although Hobsbawm's own position on the Hungarian events was somewhat ambiguous in the sense that he wrote in the Daily Worker that it was a grim necessity for the Soviet Union to suppress the uprising, yet at the same time was critical of the British Communist Party's own position in support of the uprising, saying that it shouldn't have tailed the Soviet line. This was nonetheless, of course, a traumatic moment within the historians' group. In fact, however, the decision to commission an English translation of selections from the prison notebooks, in the edition The Modern Prince I mentioned, had actually come before the invasion of Hungary in March 56, so just after the secret speech by Khrushchev. As Hobsbawm, however, would point out in his 1974 work, The Great Gramsci, it's not as simple as there being a division, of course, between, well, the British Communist Party supported the Soviet line and the Italian Party did defend the Soviet action in very similar terms to Hobsbawm himself, and it's possible that Hobsbawm's own article was actually inspired by Togliatti's own intervention. But the difference, of course, is that unlike, say, the British or French parties, the Italian party had already begun creating its own polycentric vision of communism. Precisely the tension Hobsbawm pointed to was that whereas Gramsci was a heterodox figure, it would only have been possible for him to be introduced into the world communist movement precisely by Togliatti, that is, by a Stalinist. Because of Gramsci's particular space within the imaginary of the Communist Party, as in a figure who, precisely because of his imprisonment by Mussolini, somehow stood sort of above space and time. He wasn't as directly involved in directly political decisions as were the architects of the Third Period and the Popular Front and so on. So Gramsci was both a figure who stood above a particular time and place and was therefore a genuinely international Marxist alternative to the sort of Stalinist canon, but also one who had been recovered precisely thanks to the culture of the Italian party. And polycentrism was, of course, an important theme for Hobsbawm. This was particularly expressed, I'll jump across some time here, but this was particularly expressed in the 1960s. If you think of his interest in Latin America, he in fact visited Cuba within less than 2 years of the revolution, saying it was a grand collective honeymoon that couldn't be copied elsewhere. But it's also important to recognise that as George indeed talked about, that really Holzbourne didn't sort of idealise sort of insurrectionary experiences or indeed the new movements of the 68 period, but rather focused his political outlook on building very large popular fronts able to conquer political power at the institutional level. In this regard, it's also important to consider the relevance of Italy in the sense that, unlike notably in Britain, his own country, the national political life was so strongly structured by the Cold War dividing line. Of course, since the breakdown of the Anti-Fascist Alliance in 1947, the Christian Democrats were permanently in office until 1994, whether alone or whether in coalition with other parties. And there was a conventio ad excludendum against the Communist Party never allowed to be in national office. However, over the 1950s and 1960s, the Communist Party continued to rise in national elections. From 1970, it was also able to take over regional governments. And at the 1976 general election, it scored 34% to the Christian Democrats, 38%. So, therefore, the idea that the Italian Communist Party could indeed come to power by electoral means, or at least become the first place party, seemed increasingly plausible. However, what's also important to remember in this moment was the recent experience in Chile, a country very much in both Hobsbawm's attentions and those of the PCI. Of course, Salvador Allende's experiment had been violently overthrown, and particularly in Berlinguer's reading, had shown the impossibility of the left kind of cobbling together a 51% majority in which they had a parliamentary majority, but nonetheless, in a parliament straightforwardly along Cold War dividing lines in a Western country within the United States sphere of influence. And so, of course, Berlinguer's approach in the historic compromise sought not only an engagement with Catholic Italy, such as always had been propounded by Togliatti, but also a broad governing alliance, including the Christian Democracy. After 1976 elections, of course, the Communist Party gave its passive support to a Christian Democratic government. Of course, the events surrounding the kidnapping and murder of Aldo Moro, the Christian Democrat Party president, were driven by the Red Brigade's desire to prevent such a reformist solution. And it's important to note that in Hobsbawm's own writing, there was repeated and explicit reference to Berlinguer's policy as a model of how to transcend Cold War dividing lines, as in to avoid the direct confrontation or to avoid kind of thinking, well, movements outside of the state would somehow be able to maintain a left government in power, but rather to sort of smother and overwhelm the Cold War dividing line by bringing the Communists and Christian Democrats together in government again as during the immediate post-war period. It is to restore the anti-fascist alliance. And hence, in an article in Marxism Today in June 1976, the same time as the Italian election, he explicitly credited Berlinguer with reviving the strategy of the broad alliance, the sort of strategy first systematically adopted by the international communist movement in the 1930s. And of course, this is very much a reference to Togliatti rather than Gramsci in this sense. And of course, Berlinguer himself justified the turn in reference to the Salerno turn operated by Togliatti in April 1944 rather than to the works of Gramsci himself. The glue of the alliance is anti-fascism. Also, of course, indicative of Hobsbawm's thinking in this period is his two dialogues with Giorgio Napolitano, leader of the Migliorista, i.e. the most reformist, and the most right-wing internal tendency of the PCI, the book The Italian Road to Socialism. So one of the interviews was from, September 1975, I think, and the other was from March 77, which was therefore after the meeting. So the second interview is after the meeting between Berlinguer, Santiago Carrillo, the secretary of the Spanish Communist Party, and Josu Masce of the French Communist Party in Madrid, which was the dawn of the Euro-Communist project. And what's interesting is, actually, in the first of the dialogues, the word Eurocommunism isn't mentioned, whereas in the second, it's Hobsbawm who drops it in, because there was a certain reluctance within the Italian party to actually embrace the name, the term Eurocommunism. So Amendola famously said, we don't want a revived communist international in Moscow, but neither are we trying to create one in Rome. Was, of course, precisely from Hobsbawm's perspective, that is what he wants. He wants he wants an international alternative. So his interest in Italy, it isn't just a matter of sort of the particular idiosyncrasies of Italy, but rather saying that the Italian party's approach is broadly shareable also in other countries. There was a tension here between a simple embrace of social democracy and then a reformist communism, reformist in the sense of eventually arriving at socialism rather than just social democratic, but nonetheless sort of maintaining a communist identity. But without doubt, this was an embrace of an extremely gradualist and institutional vision of socialism based on Berlinguer's own outlook. There was a striking in a comment he made in his dialogue with Napolitano, consonant with the spirit of the historic compromise. As Hobsbawm commented, in the past, communists frequently committed the error of maintaining that there's no way out of the crisis besides socialism, that capitalism cannot overcome its crises. It was able to do so in the past, and it may be able to do so yet. But the problem is one of choosing between differing solutions and not immediately assuming that the alternatives are socialism and catastrophe. This reformist outlook also informed Hobsbawm's writing on Britain itself. Significant in this regard, and highlighted by David Forgatch, was the conference held at the Polytechnic of Central London in March 77, financially supported by Lawrence and Wishart, on the 40th anniversary of Gramsci's death. Organised on the initiative of Donald Sassoon and Lucio Sponda, who were both students of Hobsbawm, it also included Italian Gramscians Bruno Trentin, Giuseppe Vacca and Nicola Badaloni. And in Forgatch's account, the conference provided the intellectual hinterland, which would then inform, which would then inform Hobsbawm's much more famous intervention, of course, the 1978 Marx Memorial Lecture, the Forward March of Labour Halted. At the 77 conference, Hobsbawm strongly asserted the political reading of Gramsci, and moreover, the centrality of politics itself to social transformation. The core not only of the strategy of winning socialism, but of socialism itself. And this set the safely essential argument of Forward March, which cast doubt on the continued strategic power of the trade union movement and highlighted the centrality of winning hegemony on the strictly political and institutional terrain. This reading, which Hobsbawm elaborated throughout the 80s, perhaps became more sort of obviously on the order of the day in Italy rather than in Britain. The defeat at the Fiat strike in Turin in 1980 was not quite as searing and general a setback for the Italian unions as was the miners' strike in Britain. Nonetheless, the PCI had already peaked as an electoral force throughout the 50s and 60s and until the 76 election. It actually increased votes at every single general election, but then in 1979-83 had setbacks. In the 84 European election, it did finally come first in the election, but pretty much because Berlinguer had died 3 days previously and there was a sort of wave of affection on the day of the vote. Clearly, there was playing out a structural crisis of the Italian labour movement, not least, so even apart from the failure of the historic compromise, the rise of the white-collar workforce, particularly as a bung by the Christian Democrat governments after the failure of the movements of 77, helped form the electoral base for Bettino Craxi's Italian Socialist Party, which was strongly opposed to the historic compromise, and despite only scoring 11% at the 83 general election, Craxi then became Prime Minister of a Christian Democrat-based government. At the same time as this demise of the industrial working class and the rise of the centre-left, there was also the dying out of the resistance generation. If perhaps in the 60s and 70s it seemed that Italy had this sort of rising industrial working class and also the political leadership of the militants trained during the war, that would only last for one generation. Already by the early 80s, the party's identity and base were sharply in decline. With Berlinguer's death, the party passed out of the hands of the resistance generation. In fact, despite declaring the propulsive force of 1917 exhausted upon the Polish coup in 81, the Italian party actually increasingly began to look to foreign models for itself to follow, either the SPD or Neil Kinnock's Labour Party, or as to Andropov and Gorbachev as reformers in the USSR. I'll hurry ahead a bit in the narrative. So I think what's interesting here in Hobsbawm is that retrospectively he was very critical of the ultimate dissolution of the Italian Communist Party in 1991. He, of course, was greatly inspired by the Gramscian tradition, but also by figures like Berlinguer, and he saw the dissolution of the party in retrospect as a kind of cultural vandalism. He famously describes the actions of those who had destroyed it as throwing out the baby and keeping the bathwater. there was a certain tendency, of course, in the early years of the post-communist parties, the DS and the PDS, what's today the Democrat Party, to sort of see the party's gradualist tradition as a kind of opportunism and sort of detach the reformist efforts made by the PC from the fact that what in the 60s and 70s they were sort of on the advance. It wasn't just an opportunist deal to manage capitalism as it actually was, whereas by the 1990s such an arrangement very much was that. Indeed, it's notable that while Hobsbawm himself never really established strong ties with, say, the dissident left, either within the Communist Party or outside it, notably the Manifesto group, there was some dialogue, but he was hardly engaged in the same way as, for example, Perry Anderson. That after the end of the Communist Party, he wrote very positive reviews of works such as Lucio Magri's Tailor of Ulm, i.e. it was precisely the people who had always opposed the majority of the Communist Party who wrote the most convincing histories of why it had failed. So, of course, the failure of the Communist Party in the 80s led Hobsbawm to embrace various rather faddish ideas, what certainly in retrospect looked like faddish ideas. For example, the idea of the European left as the alternative to national traditions and so on. Of course, it's unsurprising that Hobsbawm should have focused on the malleability of tradition and its ability to be remade anew. But the Italian Communist Party had, for him, represented an alternative to the Soviet model, one in tension between communist identity and a reforming path able to advance communist political hegemony in the immediate. And that party's failure has certainly left very profound traces on the very idea of rebuilding a Marxist left in Europe.